From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with satirist Tony Hendra, a former editor of the National Lampoon. Hendra has written a history of irreverent humor called Going Too Far. Also today, I talk with pilots Dick Rutan and Gina Yeager. They captured the world's imagination and reached one of aviation's last remaining milestones when they flew their plane Voyager around the world nonstop without refueling. The Voyager just went on exhibit at the Smithsonian. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a tribute to violinist Yasha Heifetz, who died last week at the age of 86. And with college students all across America counting the days till the end of the semester, Jan Harald Brundtvand has an urban legend about final exams. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. The rise and demise of sick, gross, black, sophomoric, weird, pinko, anarchic, underground, anti-establishment humor is the subject of Tony Hendra's new book, Going Too Far. It surveys the generation of baby boom humorists, starting with their predecessors like Lenny Bruce and Mort Saul in the 50s, and continuing with 60s comics like Smothers Brothers and Richard Pryor, and the 1970s humor of the National Lampoon and Saturday Night Live. Tony Hendra is himself one of the comic voices to emerge from the baby boom. He first came to America from England to tour his club act. He stayed and went on to edit the humor magazine The National Lampoon and to direct their Woodstock spoof Lemmings. Hendra later edited and co-wrote several satirical books, including Not the New York Times and Off the Wall Street Journal. In the heavy metal movie parody, This is Spinal Tap, he played the role of the band's manager. I spoke to Tony Hendra from the NPR Bureau in New York. I told him I was surprised that he wrote his new book, which surveys and analyzes humor, because humorists frequently resist being analyzed.
Yes, well, it's a fairly dangerous occupation, writing about humor. I tried to avoid the sort of basic problem that most people seem to get into, which is the sort of Germanic approach, you know. The joke goes in the ear and it activates the lumbar muscle, you know, and then the contractions, and then laughter is the result. You know, those kind of Freudian kind of explanations.
Right.
But I did, actually, the book started as a sort of history of the National Lampoon, which I was used to be editor of for a while, back in the days when it was good, and it became clear to me, you know, that the sort of roots and origins of the kind of stuff that we did when we were cooking there really went much further back than I had realized.
You use the phrase boomer humor to describe the kind of humor that the Lampoon was part of. Yeah, why don't you describe what you mean?
Well, it's an unfortunate term, but and so is rock and roll.
You made it up, right?
Right. So is rock and roll, you know. It's self-explanatory to the extent that it's a humor, I think, that is sort of peculiar to what we call the baby boom generation, whatever that is. I actually do think that perhaps the comparison to rock and roll is not without merit, in the sense that I think our generation has as distinctive a kind of humor as our music is, and that's why I set out to try and put it all in one place.
One of the distinctions you give to this kind of humor is that it frequently goes too far, or that people think it would, and that it tackles previously off-limit subjects. And I wonder what you're comparing it to. You're comparing this to, say, Bob Hope, whose humor seems very tame by comparison?
Well, it's, there's two issues here. One is that this is not the only kind of humor. You know, I'm not suggesting that there's no other kind that makes people laugh or should. You know, there's easy listening and there's rock and roll and there's heavy metal. I mean, this is a certain kind of humor, other kinds of humor continue parallel. But I think the most, from a historical point of view, the most interesting thing is that what preceded this was a very different and gentler and more trivial kind of humor that found its expression with people like extremely funny people, I should add, like Buddy Hackett and Milton Berle and Jackie Leonard, that whole tradition of sort of grand old ethnic comedians who really stayed in very safe areas of the park. And what made Mort Saul and Lenny Bruce and Second City critically different was that on the one hand, they were quite determinedly intelligent. I mean, they were smart comedians in a world where basically the sillier and more stupid you were, the funnier you were. They also dealt with issues which previously had been completely off limits. The Cold War, sexism, racism, all kinds of issues which comedians wouldn't touch with a barge pole before that.
Well, for a while you edited National Lampoon, mm-hmm. and you wrote for them. Now, you were something of an outsider in the sense that you were British, so there. Here's what I think. That there were probably a lot of like American in jokes and jokes about Howdy Doody and TV shows and things like that that uh-huh. that you maybe weren't that keyed into having come from England. I don't know. Were you from a slightly different?
I think I better shoot myself.
Oh, yeah. Is this what the question made you think about?
Actually, I think yes, obviously, a great deal of, I have been in this country for a quarter of a century, and I'm beginning to understand, that you say can't, not can't, stuff like that. But no, it took me a long time to understand the nuance of, if you like, to learn American in both the language sense and the cultural sense. But
What I'm thinking is that so much of... the Lampoon and a lot of humor is based on little shared experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And TV shows, radio shows, bubblegum cards, things like that, that you wonder, how much of it would relate, overseas.
Well, it's, as I say, first of all, I've spent almost all my professional career here.
Yeah.
And I was one of the original editors of The Lampoon, so however... I suppose I got away with it somehow. It does seem to me, though, that there is something else special about this kind of humor, which actually I hadn't thought about before. There was a very parallel and similar phenomenon in England, which began in the mid-50s, as this kind of humor did in America, with people like Peter Sellers and The Goon Show and Peter Cook and Dudley Moore and Beyond the Fringe, and That Was the Week That Was. A very similar kind of humor that, took on very similar kind of targets. I think one of the things that distinguishes this kind of humor is that it was not based in the trivial. It was not based in, the recognition of, an old-time television commercial. It was about the Pentagon. It was about, mm-hmm. It was about the church. It was about religious and sexual hypocrisy. It was... In a sense, those are universal subjects. I don't think it matters what language you speak.
You describe The Lampoon as having turned on the last thing that was sacred, which was that generation itself, the generation writing the Lampoon.
Uh-huh. Well, I think that's always been the saving grace of boomer humorists. I mean, that they were able to be as funny about themselves as they were about the people that they were attacking. Jules Pfeiffer is a prime example of that. I mean, his stuff right from the start was as much about people who you would assume were on his side as it was about, the half-wits in charge. And I think we not only carried on the tradition in its more obvious ways, like, attacking the government and organized religion and so off, but we also identified the new generation of half-wits, the managers of Woodstock Nation, who were just as full of it as the last lot. And that was one of our unique things, I think, at the Lampoon.
Sure, you did a whole parody of Woodstock called the Woodshuck Festival.
Sure, Lemmings. And, Lemmings.
Yeah, event, yeah.
Which, that was an off-Broadway hit in 1973. It actually had Belushi and Chevy Chase and Christopher Guest. Pretty impressive. Bunch of people.
Did you offend any people with it?
I remember it was a series the whole second act was a parody of Woodstock, and it had a series of parodies of singers, not all of whom were at Woodstock, some of those singers actually came to see the show. I remember one night James Taylor and Carly Simon came, and it was an extremely savage James Taylor parody. In the show, and he didn't laugh at all. Carly, however, fell on the floor.
and remember, they got divorced later on.
yes. This, I probably caused that.
Did you write that parody?
No, actually, Sean Kelly wrote that.
Now you did write a John Lennon parody on.
Yes, that was on an early National Lampoon album called Radio Dinner. As a matter of fact, John Lennon wrote that parody. All the words in that song are from the Primal Therapy interviews, Primal Scream interviews he gave to Rolling Stone. So every single word in that song is actually from the very gut of John Lennon.
Do you remember any of it? Could you recite some of it for us?
No, I really couldn't. Not even on National Public Radio.
Oh, right. Okay,
You perhaps don't remember quite how demotic it was.
Right. Now, did Lennon ever hear it?
Yes, apparently some idiot in KRLA played it to him and Yoko, and he was described as emerging ashen-faced after hearing it.
Now, I don't know if he was important to you musically, but how did it make you feel knowing that he was really offended by it?
Well, I didn't know that for sure. I mean, I certainly don't think... It was a strange experience. I mean, I don't think you can really do satire, and certainly not parody, unless you, in a funny kind of way, love your target, you know? It did seem to me that what those interviews were indicating was a sort of egomania, you know, a kind of self-obsession that Lennon was getting into at that time, which was very disappointing because he really was a hero of mine. So, I mean, I don't really care if he was offended. I think the song actually had a point to make. But it was only worth making because I cared about him.
Another parody that you wrote was Deteriorata, based on Desiderata.
Uh-huh.
could you recall for us what Desiderata was, and maybe you can recite a verse of Deteriorata?
Gosh, I can't remember it. Desiderata was this awful, soupy, sentimental thing. Go placidly amid the noise and waste, was it? Sorry?
Oh, well, posters of it were hung on countless dormitory
walls.
Oh,
yes. No, it was as popular as the Velvet Jesus. It was all over the place. And it was this dreadful sort of reader's... It was supposed to have been discovered in an old Pennsylvania church, I think, or something like that. It was, and it had this sort of phony 18th century diction.
And it was kind of Hallmark inspirational.
Yeah. But definitely came from sort of Reader's Digest. And so anyway, we wrote a parody of it. I wrote a parody of it, which was called Deteriorata. And I really, honestly can't remember any of Deteriorata, except...
The part I remember is that you are a fluke of the universe. You have no right to be here.
Hey. Yes, pretty good. Let not the sands of time get in your lunch. Hire people with hooks.
That's right.
Coming back to you now. Yeah. Anyway, that became a not nearly so large selling poster, but we did sell a few of them.
Now, on one of your records, you write in your new book, Going Too Far, that RCA refused to release it unless you deleted the satires of relating to President Nixon and to Julian David Eisenhower. How did that wind up?
That was the same album on which the Lennon parody appeared, and a number of other things, including an extremely nasty parody of Joan Baez. I must say, there were these very harmless things about David and Julie in bed, you know, with David saying things like, don't worry, honey, I took the pills, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, real tame stuff. And what I was really worried about was that the record industry would just go nuts when they heard this sort of Lennon knock and Baez knock, and there was a Dylan parody on it too. But they didn't care a bit. What they cared about was the fact that they just sold... something like a quarter of $1 billion worth of defense contracts to the Nixon administration. Well, they just made a deal. Anyway, this is RCA, of course, is a defense contractor. So the word came down that they wanted anything about Nixon off the album. And we refused to take it off, and they booted us. But that's a common story with boomer humor, you know. I mean, that's what you never know how you're going too far. I mean, I don't think Tommy Smothers knew how he was going too far. I don't think any of us did.
Well, certainly the risk you always take if your humor really cuts deep.
Yes, sure, but in this case it didn't. You know?
Right.
I mean, I would have been much less surprised if somebody had said you've got to take that John Lennon thing off. Yeah. You know, we can't possibly. Can't possibly put that out.
You described the...
Right from the start, I mean, I realized that was one of the risks that you take. I mean, when when I first came here in 1964, I was half of a comedy team. Since I weighed 240 pounds, I was considerably more than half of a comedy team. But our first job, I mean, within 24 hours, we got this job. 24 hours getting off the boat, we got the job opening for Lenny Bruce.
You're kidding.
Yes, at the, no, I'm not kidding, at the Café Agogo in New York. And it was just staggering because this guy was, you know, one of our sort of major idols. So we would sort of, I don't know why he needed us to open for him, actually. No one was remotely interested in our twittering British satire. But we would sit there night after night, you know, feet of this great man. And lo and behold, 3 days into the gig, in the middle of a set, the New York Police Department bounced up on stage and busted him. So, you know, our first lesson was that if you're too funny in America, you get arrested.
Boy, I see you didn't take that one to heart, though.
No.
It's interesting, you know, you describe P.J. O'Rourke, who was an editor at the Lampoon, uh-huh. as basically leading the Lampoon to its downfall. And what interests me about this is that O'Rourke is now known as a kind of Republican satirist, a conservative satirist. And I think
you don't see that as a contradiction in terms.
Well, here's what I'm going to say, that I think a lot of, you know, irreverent humor in America is always associated with liberalism or with the left.
Mm-hmm.
And here he was at the Lampoon, being pretty conservative then, too, I think. As a matter of fact, you say someone described him as a narc, because you always thought you could see his police-issue shoes showing out from his bell-bottoms.
Uh-huh.
Well, how do you think he changed the Lampoon?
Well, actually, I'd like to address the issue of satire being left-wing, because I don't think that's necessarily true at all. I think it seems to me a distinctive of this humor that it dealt with, you know, authority figures. It deals with people more powerful than you, and it doesn't really matter who's in charge, whether they're left-wing or right-wing or in the middle. You know, if the chances are that if someone's in charge, there's something ludicrous about them. And that's the job of satirists, is point that out. I think, in fact, historically, you find that, you know, this kind of satire flourished more than ever under the Kennedy administration, which I suppose is as close to left-wing as we've gotten in the last 30 years. And, you know, that sort of gives the lie to the fact that it was necessarily left-wing or liberal. The other thing, though, is that I think what O'Rourke and a lot of people like him do is, and it's something I find obnoxious and not at all funny, is that they make fun of people who are less powerful than them. In other words, they make fun of the powerless, whether that's whatever form that takes. And I just simply don't find that funny. I mean, I think it's not a worthy sort of target, and. The kind of changes that O'Rourke and other people too made in the Lampoon seem to me to both, you know, have destroyed it as a sort of reasonable expression of its generation's humor, and just to have cheapened it, you know, in a way that eventually destroyed it. I mean, I think the Lampoon, if it had, so to speak, grown up with its audience instead of becoming a teenager's magazine, could have become the New Yorker of its generation.
So very briefly, you thought that the magazine became more adolescent, catering to...
Oh, quite deliberately.
Tittering type jokes, sex
yes,
jokes.
Yes, I mean, I don't know if you can put this on the air, but we used to call it zits and tits.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of humor became the only kind of humor that the National Lampoon specialized in.
Well, Tony Hendra, I want to talk with you more about humor and about your own life, but we're going to take a short break first. My guest is Tony Hendra. He's been an editor of the National Lampoon. He produced some of their records, and he edited Not the New York Times, Off the Wall Street Journal. He appeared in This is Spinal Tap as the manager, and he's the author of a new book about humor called Going Too Far. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is humorist Tony Hendra, author of the new book, Going Too Far. One of the things you write in your book is that you think some of the people who were associated with the Lampoon and with Saturday Night Live ended up becoming some of the things that they parodied, especially because of their involvement and or over-involvement with drugs.
Well, actually, I'm not sure that drugs were quite as big a sickness as stardom.
Oh, ego. Uh-huh. Right.
It seemed to me that, I have really no idea what, certainly there weren't many drugs around the Lampoon. There was a lot of alcohol, but certainly wasn't many drugs.
Uh-huh. And
I have no idea what was around, say, SNL. I think Saturday Night was probably did, on the whole, in retrospect, did the cause of boomer humor somewhat of a disservice. Partly, I think, because it was promoted as being something that it really, in effect, wasn't. I mean, it gave the appearance of being, you know, radical and revolutionary, whereas, in fact, what the material, if you go back and look at the material, what the material was actually very tame. And I think people sort of got the idea that they were getting real going too far humor when, in fact, they weren't. They were getting parodies of Star Trek.
Well, you know, there's a big comedy renaissance going on in America, lots of comedy clubs, more comedy shows on television.
Mm-hmm.
Yet you end your book Going Too Far with a chapter called Semi-Epitaph, in which you mourn the near death of boomer humor.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think it's I don't think it's dead. I certainly think it's probably in intensive care, but it's not actually
what are the symptoms?
Straight-lined yet. Well, I think one of the symptoms is that, to be quite honest, with some exceptions, which I'll get to, I don't hear many comedians today, however talented they may be, dealing with anything that I care about. You know, I mean, you have this tradition where, you know, Saal dealt with the Eisenhower administration, the military, Bruce dealt with moral and religious hypocrisy, Carlin dealt with Catholicism, Lily Tomlin deals with, you know, feminist issues, and what have we got today? Stupid pet tricks. Great, let's rip the lid off stupid pets, huh? That's, you know, that's about where we're at. That's as shocking and as dangerous as it gets. And I quite honestly, I think pets are stupid, but I don't really have to be told. It just seems to me that most of what I see in here today is not about things that that you know cut deep at all.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask?
Now,
you, yeah,
I should
go, no,
I should
go ahead.
Say by the way that I think that I do think that that there are exceptions to that. I mean, obviously, you know, most of these people are not by any means dead. I mean, I think Carlin continues to be a great comedian,
mm-hmm.
and I actually think that of the sort of late 80s funny people, the most interesting are the women. You know, and I include Lily and Whoopi and Elaine Boozler and Roseanne Barr amongst all those people. They seem to me to be much more sort of lively and I don't know, perhaps they have more to be angry about, but much more than their male counterparts.
Tony Hendra, can I ask you a question that might be totally off the wall and ludicrous?
No.
Thanks, I'll do it. Yeah. Have you ever been a monk or a priest?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure if I'd made that up or not.
No. I was actually a Benedictine monk for not very long. I was a postulant, which meant I spent about 6 months in the monastery.
It's maybe not, but it seems to me to be two really different professions here, being a monk and being a humorist. Can you mm-hmm. see any connection between the two?
Well, I think Jesus was a comedian. I do. I actually think he probably made people laugh with some of that stuff, you know?
Uh-huh.
You know, camel through the eye of a needle, all that. I mean, that probably passed for good stand-up humor in biblical times.
Well, did you consider yourself very funny back in the days when you were a postulant? No, seriously, some people say that, some humorists say that they never had a sense of humor till they got older or they didn't think about it.
Uh-huh.
I have heard that from...
Well, I don't know. I suppose. I might be different in this respect, but I must say I've always had a certain sort of seriousness of purpose about what I do for a living, even though it's supposed to make people laugh. And I suppose there's some connection there. And I think that's you know. But I mean I remember certainly going to see Beyond the Fringe, you know, I went in as someone fully expecting to re-enter the monastery after I'd finished university, and I came out wanting to be a satirist. And that's all it took, you know.
How did you get out? Did you say, Father, I changed my mind. I want to be a comic.
I don't remember, actually. Maybe I should go to confession. Jeez. Please, I made fun of the church. I made fun of the Pope. Yeah.
Well, you know, I could see how there'd be more guilt that you'd have to face doing irreverent humor.
Yes, I guess so. Yeah, I guess so. I think, as somebody said in the book, the thing about being a lapsed Catholic, which unfortunately I am now, is that even though you don't believe in hell, you know you're going there.
I've seen a lot of comics who strike me as real manic depressive, manic when they're on, but really depressed when they're off. I don't know if that's something that you feel is true, but if it is for a lot of people, I wonder if you have any insights about it.
Well, that's a real depressing question, Terry. I do think it certainly seemed to me that in the various sort of collectives of which I've been part one time or another, I have never met. I mean, I couldn't identify a group of people who are so hard on one another. It's real tough being around very funny people because they just, you know, metaphorically pull your pants down all the time, and it's. I don't know that there is any more. I mean, manic depressives in the comedy community than there are in, say, you know, the Pentagon.
Well, let me ask you the much-awaited question. I'm sure about forthcoming projects. What are you working on now?
At the moment, my main project is a sort of satirical opera, which I'm doing at Lincoln Center, which is based very loosely on Don Giovanni. Except that it's about the Reagan administration, Act One and Act Two. So it's called Ron Giovanni. And it's about the greatest seducer of our time who seduces everyone in sight, including the American public, and then goes to hell.
Now, is it true you just shot a few episodes of Miami Vice?
Yes, actually two. This is a great culmination of a distinguished comedic career. I was hired as a corrupt record executive. A big stretch for me, huh? my aim in life is to kill Don Johnson's new wife, Sheena Easton.
Oh, but you're probably under embargo against telling us whether the mission is accomplished.
Yes, I am. But I can tell you that I did find myself on one shoot underneath Don Johnson at 3 o'clock in the morning, which is presumably the dream of some of us. He busted me.
Oh, dear.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about humor and about your life. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been Tony Hendra, and he spoke with us from the NPR Bureau in New York. He has edited the National Lampoon, directed the Lampoon satirical review Lemmings, co-created, produced, and wrote the British satire on TV, Spitting Image, and appeared in the film This Is Spinal Tap. His new book is about humor. It's titled Going Too Far. It's published by Doubleday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with cultural critic for Vanity Fair magazine, James Wolcott, so I hope you can join us.
Go placidly amid the noise and waste, and remember what comfort there may be in owning a piece thereof. Avoid quiet and passive persons unless you are in need of sleep. Rotate your tires. Speak glowingly of those greater than yourself, and heed well their advice, even though they be turkeys. Know what to kiss and when. Consider that two wrongs never make a right, but that three do. Wherever possible, put people on hold. Be comforted that in the face of all aridity and disillusionment, and despite...
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, from a hangar in California to the Smithsonian, pilots Dick Rutan and Gina Yeager talk about the nonstop, around-the-world flight that landed Yeager and Rutan in the record books and their plane Voyager in the National Air and Space Museum. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz remembers violinist Yasha Heifetz. And it's that time of year again. I don't mean the holidays. I mean final exams. And our urban legends expert Jan-Harald Brunvand has a story suitable for the season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. Former White House aide Michael Deaver was found guilty today on three counts in his perjury trial in Washington. The close personal friend of President and Mrs. Reagan was convicted of one count of perjury and two counts of false declaration for testimony he gave about his lobbying activities after leaving the White House. After the verdict, Deaver spoke with reporters outside the federal courthouse in Washington.
I'm obviously very disappointed, but at the same time, knowing my heart, and I'm innocent.
Deaver was convicted of lying to a federal grand jury and a congressional subcommittee while he was accused of violating federal ethics laws. He faces a maximum of 15 years in prison and up to $22,000 in fines. His lawyers say they will appeal today's verdict. Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega today announced a two-day Christmas truce with U.S.-backed rebels. Ortega said during the truce on December 24th and 25th, Nicaraguan troops will fight only if attacked or to defend civilians. Ortega also said peace talks with the Contras will resume after Christmas. The American Bar Association today endorsed Anthony Kennedy as a man whose integrity, temperament, and intelligence make him highly qualified to be a Supreme Court justice. That assessment came on the third day of confirmation hearings by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Harvard Law professor Lawrence Tribe also testified today, saying Judge Kennedy is not guided by ideology in his interpretation of the Constitution.
What I find most appealing and promising about the picture that emerges is precisely the absence of any simplistic, single, fixed point of view. There is, I think, great intelligence and fair-mindedness and commitment to principle, but no unitary vision, nothing you could put on a bumper sticker.
There was some opposition to the Kennedy nomination today. National Organization for Women President Molly Yard said several of the appeals court judge's decisions and his former membership in restricted clubs show he is not committed to civil rights. Government candidate No Tae-woo held a strong lead today in early returns from South Korea's first direct presidential elections in 16 years. However, opposition forces claimed massive fraud, charges that South Korea's government denied. More than 70,000 police and military troops were on alert nationwide to prevent trouble. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees today appealed to France to allow the return of at least some members of the Iranian political opposition expelled recently to the African country of Gabon. Although French officials have denied it, the expulsion is widely seen as part of a deal that resulted in the release last month of two French hostages held by a pro-Iranian group in Lebanon. Burton Bolag reports.
French authorities say they expelled the 14 Iranians and three Turks because they represented a threat to public safety. The High Commissioner for Refugees is asking for assurances the Iranians will not be returned to Iran, where they could face imprisonment or death for their opposition to the Khomeini regime. Since their expulsion 8 days ago, the refugees have been under virtual house arrest in a hotel in Gabon's capital, Libreville. All but one are on hunger strike. In Geneva today, the High Commissioner for Refugees asked France to allow the return of two who have been hospitalized and of one young woman who was apparently expelled in place of her father, who the police could not find. For National Public Radio, this is Burton Bolag in Geneva.
Gary Hart said today he does not think politicians should lie to the public, and on the other hand, he said the public does not have a right to know every detail about the private lives of their political leaders. The former Colorado senator was in New Hampshire today with his regenerated presidential campaign. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 31 points today to close at 1972.64. Advances led declines in very active trading of 193 million shares. I'm Sharon Green in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, has a tribute to Yasha Heifetz, the Russian-born violinist who died last week. Many of his fellow musicians considered Heifetz the greatest violin player of the century. Lloyd agrees, but also says there may be more to being a violinist than just playing violin.
There's a famous story that when the 16-year-old Yasha Heifetz made his American debut at Carnegie Hall in 1917, violinist Misha Elman turned to the pianist Leopold Godofsky and whispered, "It's hot in here." "Not for pianists," Godofsky replied. Like Kleenex or Xerox, the name Heifetz quickly became generic. How many mothers around the world wanted their violin-playing prodigies to become Heifetzes? Last Thursday, Heifetz died at the age of 86. He'd begun playing in public when he was 5 and retired from performing in 1972. Like pianist Vladimir Horowitz, Heifetz was a virtuoso whose technical gifts were so extraordinary they almost prevented him from becoming a great musician. Things came too easy. The effortless, gorgeous tone. Creamy, no scraping, even in the most ferocious passages. Yet sinewy, no schmaltzy sentimentality either. For all his mastery of the romantic repertoire, Heifetz was one of the most aristocratic performers. No swaying, bobbing, or weaving, not even a smile. He held the violin very still and very high. He was the John Barrymore of classical music, the great profile. It's not surprising that his best chamber music recordings were with such other musical aristocrats as Arthur Rubinstein and cellist Emanuel Feuermann. The tension in his playing, and there was tension, probably lay just in that place where romanticism intersects with classical austerity. That's what makes his Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto under Fritz Reiner such a remarkable recording, or his Sibelius Concerto with Sir Thomas Beecham, or Prokofiev's Second with Koussevitzky, both very first recordings. The problem with performing these works is not to overplay them, and Heifetz didn't have to. Heifetz was always musical. His violin could sing. In the most profound music, however, Bach or Mozart, wherever you wanted something more probing or playful, a way of getting inside the music, thinking and feeling it, moving with it, you don't especially want to hear Heifetz. He couldn't approach Joseph Szigeti's variety of tone or phrasing, or Fritz Kreisler for sheer sweetness of sound and temperament. You wouldn't turn to Heifetz for Berg or Schoenberg or Bartok either, because he didn't play them, though he did champion and even commission a significant number of more conservative contemporary pieces. Like Horowitz, too, Heifetz made many transcriptions, pieces like the Gershwin Piano Preludes or selections from Porgy and Bess. RCA recently reissued what was probably his most famous recording, the Beethoven Violin Concerto under Toscanini. For the first time since its original release in 1940, you can actually hear what this performance sounded like. It's a remarkable collaboration, elegant, distant, heroic, with surprisingly eloquent lyric passages. In the last movement, it all galvanizes, takes powerful flight. He could do that, too. Thank you.
Yasha Heifetz playing the Beethoven Violin Concerto. Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. This is Fresh Air. It's been 1 year since Dick Rutan and Gina Yeager took off in the Voyager aircraft and flew nonstop around the world, 26,000 miles, without refueling. On Monday, the plane went on permanent display at the Smithsonian's Air and Space Museum. Rutan and Yeager have written a book, Voyager, that tells the story of their historic 9-day flight and chronicles the years of planning, building, and testing the plane. The strange-looking lightweight aircraft was designed by Dick's brother Bert and was built by hand by a group of volunteers.
Big business could not have done this project. It would have taken too much money. There was too many compromises. We broke a lot of general aviation practices, rules, if you would, not laws, but rules. We took a lot more risks than any corporation would stand. They have to have certain safety factors in the way they go about their business. And too much compromise, too many committees.
Could you describe the basic design principle of the Voyager?
Design an airplane that was very aerodynamically efficient. And that was quite a challenge. And doing that, we ended up with a lot of compromises in controllability, comfort, flying qualities, noise. So it was an extreme compromise. It was a very strange airplane. That's why we brought it on a truck to the Smithsonian instead of flying it back here.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's a state-of-the-art design on the outside. But in the inside, in the cockpit, you had to live absolutely primitively.
That would probably be a...
an understatement?
Well... Primitive would probably be an understatement. That's true. It was very primitive. Everything in that thing was for the lightness and the efficiency and nothing with creature comforts whatsoever.
Well, why don't you describe what the cockpit was like?
Well, the cockpit itself, the seat where the pilot sat, was a semi-supine arrangement, kind of like an easy chair, except there wasn't any cushions or anything. The other off-duty crew member was beside in kind of a little long, narrow tube, if you would, for a bed area where you could lay down flat, and we had to change positions from one to the other as we traded off crew duty.
Gina, what was it like when you had to trade positions? How would you do it, since there was so little space to maneuver?
It was a real scamper.
That's what we called, it wasn't impossible, but very close to it. It was, basically, I'd get as close to the front as I could, and Dick would pass in behind me, and I'd slip over his legs and onto the pilot seat. And it was reverse action for the opposite. It was a real shuffle there for a few minutes.
I feel a little uncomfortable bringing it up, but considering how cramped you were, what did you do for toileting on the Voyager?
Gina's pointed at me. She doesn't like to talk about it.
Is this an okay thing to bring up?
Well, I'll answer any question that somebody has enough courage to ask. There was just a funnel with a tube that handled the urine. The defecation was handled in a special bag that was used that's used in all hospitals, so it's very common, actually.
Dick, in your book about the Voyager, you write that, unlike Gina, that you hated and you feared the plane.
Well, I did. I had a terrible premonition. I didn't like its flying qualities. I didn't enjoy flying the airplane. It was work. I had this premonition it was going to kill me. So I was very apprehensive about the airplane, and we had trouble flying the airplane locally because of just local turbulence. And in the back of my mind all the time, I kept thinking, I got to fly this thing around the world, and there's terrible weather out there. How are we going to handle that? And it was an overriding fear that grated on my soul for about 3 years before the flight, and it was kind of tough to deal with. It took a lot of in me to get into that airplane each time. I didn't like it.
Gina, when Dick would tell you about his premonition, would you feel that kind of premonition too, or would you try to talk him out of his?
No, I felt very strong that the project was going to be a go. And I never really look for excuses to get out of it or reasons to quit. I had intended to do the project, and I intended to give every effort to make it a go.
One of the things that you say, Dick, about the Voyager is that it reasserted the importance of the pilot. I mean, you had to be a really skilled pilot to manipulate this plane around storms and through mountains. What is one of the maneuvers while you were flying around the world that you're most proud of?
Well, the airplane was very difficult. I felt that every time I flew it that I had to draw on 30 years of flying experience to bring it to a success. And I don't know, getting it through Africa was probably one of the things that I finally got across the African continent and through that horrible weather and found that we were over the Atlantic Ocean at last and still alive. And it was quite an emotional experience for me, probably the most emotional one of the whole flight.
It was an emotional and physical experience. You know, you were really sick during that part of the flight. You had a terrible migraine headache. You were throwing up during part of it, yet you were also at the controls during part of it.
No, it was necessary for the survival of it. I had started out the project with a cold, and unfortunately when we went to altitude, I wasn't absorbing enough of the oxygen we had regulated and figured our needs. And as we got to altitude and with the cold, I just didn't have quite enough, so I was having a hard time. But Dick was going into a very fatigued state, and it was necessary to take over at that point. And he was in worse shape than I was.
Gina, I got the impression that throughout the flight that you were the one who kept kind of saying, we can do it, we have to, that you kept trying to rejuvenate both your spirits and Dick's spirits throughout the flight.
There were times when I decide I'm going to do something, I'm going to stay with it. And I had a strong premonition, instinct, whatever, that kept telling me that this was going to happen, and we just had to keep trying. And I kept forging that way and hoping Dick would stay with me.
Was there a moment during the flight around the world when you knew that you had it made, when you were in the clear and it was going to work?
I can remember seeing the lights of Los Angeles slip underneath the nose that morning just before we landed, and the realization that we had really done this thing. That's Los Angeles again, and we're home, we made it. And then finally, coming across that cloud bank and looking down at Edwards Air Force Base and seeing as many thousands of people on the dry lake was just something you couldn't describe. It's something we never expected, or was something we were never aware of at all.
I never really considered the flight over until we had the airplane roll to a stop. And then when you get out and you realize, finally, that all this hard work and everyone's efforts, everything had finally come together. The record had been achieved. You know, it was very proud and very exhilarating and very special moment for all of us.
Do you still love to fly? I mean, you really had your fill on that flight.
Well, the Voyager did, the Voyager aircraft itself did almost instill a fear of flying with me that I had to work on a little bit. And no, I've overcome that problem. As soon as the Voyager landed and rolled to a stop, I was 100% shape again with no problem, knowing that I wouldn't have to get back in it again. And it would go to its final resting place on a truck, and we could all be proud of it that way.
Gina, what about you? Did you experience any fear of flying after the flight? Do you still enjoy flying?
Well, I still very much enjoy flying. I just finishing up another part of my goal, one of my life goals of getting back to the helicopter. Mm-hmm. I've had the opportunity to learn a little bit and have soloed in the helicopter, and now looking for a little extra time and go back and get the full rating.
After you completed the Voyager flight, did you ever sit in the Voyager again? Did you ever go back into the plane?
I don't think I ever did. All of us that were involved in this thing, we lived this thing daily. Every little part of it we developed and put together and built and agonized and tested. And every time we'd come back from a test flight, we'd have all kinds of things wrong with the airplane. Some things that would fail, some things that we had to modify, some things that we had to improve. And that was our life for 2.5 years. And we landed on that dry lake that day. I grabbed those guys and I says, you know something? There's still a lot of things wrong with this airplane. But you know what's neat? We don't have to fix any of them. The Smithsonian said we want it just exactly the way it was when it landed. So when you go and visit it in the Smithsonian, you'll see the oil streaks on the bottom. And you'll see you'll still see, if you look closely, a strange yellow streak from the cockpit going back. Nothing was cleaned off the airplane. It's exactly the way it was when it landed. Everything that was broke then is still broke, and we didn't fix anything.
What is that yellow streak?
That's part of the, there's a little tube sticking out there that was a urine extraction tube, so. That was a strange thing. But anyway, like I'm saying, it was right the way it was. Nobody looked at it anymore. They just bundled it up and sent it to the Smithsonian.
Okay, well, Gina Yeager, Dick Rutan, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
You bet. My pleasure.
Rutan and Yeager's new book, Voyager, is published by Knopf. The Voyager aircraft is now on permanent display at the National Air and Space Museum. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne co-hosts the program, and she's joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What's coming up?
Tonight, we continue to follow the presidential election in South Korea, and we'll have several stories on the American presidential candidate, Gary Hart, and his reborn candidacy. Among those stories, we'll take a look at what the polls have been saying. Gary Hart, as it turns out, may have taken heart from the fact that even while he was out of the race, the polls showed he was still at the top of the Democratic heap. He was leading virtually all the other candidates. Also, a return tonight to Marion Prison. That's the federal prison that officially replaced Alcatraz as the punitive penitentiary. It's where the authorities send what they call the incorrigibles.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. While most of us are in the holiday spirit of exchanging gifts, teachers and students on college campuses are partaking in another ritual, the giving and taking of exams. Our urban legends expert, Jan Harald Brunvand, has some campus tales to share.
College final exam time is upon us, and the latest chapter in the book of teacher-student legends deals with stories that pertain to this stressful subject. For example, a professor giving a final examination in a large class tells the students that time is up and insists that they stop writing. But one student continues to write in his exam blue book for another minute or so, and then he steps forward to turn in his work. The professor refuses to accept the exam. "What will happen to me?" the student asks. "You'll fail the class, of course," the professor replies. Though the student pleads and argues, the professor stands fast by his rule. Finally, the student asks, "Do you know who I am?" "No," says the professor, "and furthermore, I don't care." "Good," says the student. And he thrusts his blue book into the middle of the pile of identical test booklets, and he walks out. Chalk one up for the crafty undergraduate in the ongoing battle of wits between faculty and students. This story is apocryphal, but whenever students tell it, they say that it happened on their campus. Another such legend involves a professor who announces an open book final examination and tells the students, "You may use anything you can carry into the classroom." This much of the story may be true, but I'm doubtful about the rest. Supposedly, one clever undergraduate took the professor at his word and carried in a graduate student to write his exam for him. Another campus legend is told from the instructor's viewpoint. A professor briefly steps out of his office, leaving the door open and a pile of examinations to be given the next day on his desk. A student comes by to ask a question, and when he finds the room empty, he steals one exam. But the professor had counted the exams, and the next morning he decides to count them once again before going to the classroom. Discovering that one is missing, he cuts 1/2 inch from the bottom of all the remaining exams. When the exam papers are turned in, the student whose paper is 1/2 inch longer than the others receives a failing grade. The classic college examination story concerns a cryptic test question. This time a philosophy professor supposedly gives his class the final exam question in just a single word, why. The professor, according to folklore, then awards an A grade only to the student who answers simply, why not? Or another version, the student's successful answer to why is because. In a more detailed variation of the story, the college is Harvard and the course is freshman metaphysics. When the students are settled in for the final exam, the teacher places a chair on the desk in the front of the room. "Prove that this chair exists," he says. "You have 2 hours." As the students begin to chew their pencils and roll their eyes, one student writes simply, "What chair?" He submits his paper and leaves the room just as the others begin to scribble furiously. As the story goes, this student gets an A, too. It's campus legends such as these that help reduce the strains of college life and keep hopes alive of outfoxing the professors or outfoxing the students, depending upon which side of the battle you are on.
Jan-Harald Brunvand is professor of English and folklore at the University of Utah. Write us at Fresh Air with urban legends you've heard, and we'll pass them on to him. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with poet and former punk rocker Richard Hell. He wrote the punk anthem Blank Generation. Now he's editing a poetry journal. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review Rainbow, the new album by Dolly Parton. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review Broadcast News, the new romantic comedy that takes a satiric look at television news. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's show is produced by Fred Landerl, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.